From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! There's an epidemic of breast cancer in this country. We'll look at poisons, profits, and prevention.
It's a scary thing because we are exposed through our food, through our air, and through our water. A lot of the stuff that's getting sprayed in terms of herbicides and pesticides contains some of these things. And although we banned PCBs and DDT, they're very toxic, very persistent, and they don't disappear from the environment for a very long time.
Also, the president will give out the first awards for microenterprise. Does microcredit help the poor? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A new study points out that 14% of black males have lost the right to vote because of felony convictions. The report comes from the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit advocacy group. The study says African Americans go to prison at a rate more than 7.5 times that of whites. A spokesperson for the Sentencing Project says policies should focus more on crime prevention than on imprisonment. And a federal magistrate yesterday ruled against Alabama's use of hitching posts to restrain prison inmates, rejecting the state's claim that it wasn't intended as punishment. The U.S. Magistrate Vanzetta Penn McPherson wrote, "Short of death by electrocution, the hitching posts may be the most painful and torturous punishment administered by the Alabama prison system." The decision settles the last remaining practice cited in a lawsuit challenging Alabama's 1995 return to chain gangs as illegally cruel. Peru blasted martial music in the early hours this morning at rebels holding 72 hostages at the Japanese ambassador's home as part of a stepped-up police effort to weaken the guerrilla's resolve in the 44-day siege. The military tunes blaring from three loudspeakers placed around the residence shattered the night's silence around the capital's middle-class district of San Isidro just after 1 Eastern Standard Time. The noise woke neighbors who came to their windows and doorsteps stare dazed at the speakers. The soundtrack played for about half an hour included the noise of aircraft, creating the impression helicopters and planes approaching the fortified compound. President Clinton is presenting the Presidential Awards for Excellence in Microenterprise Development. We'll have more on that story later in the show. State Department will release today the annual Human Rights Report. Ralph Reed, the executive director of the Christian Coalition, will be holding a news conference to announce the coalition's legislative agenda for the 105th Congress. And Senate Governmental Affairs Committee Chairman Fred Thompson will try once again to get his $6.5 million budget to investigate campaign finance abuses. The Senate is moving forward on a balanced budget amendment. The Judiciary Committee is set to vote today on the Republican-backed measure. President Clinton is against the measure. Among other things, he says it could pose grave risks to the Social Security system. And the New England Journal of Medicine has come out in favor of allowing doctors to prescribe marijuana for medical purposes, calling the threat of government sanctions misguided, heavy-handed, and inhumane. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In recent weeks, two different government agencies, the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute, have been embroiled in a debate over whether women between the ages of 40 and 50 should get mammograms. But lost in the noise of the debate are the actual causes of breast cancer. Today we'll hear from two people. First, we'll go to an excerpt of a speech by Dr. Ernest J. Sternglass, who is a professor emeritus of radiology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. And then we'll talk to Leanne Clorfine Kasten. She is the author of a book called Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. First to Dr. Sternglass, talking about nuclear fallout and nuclear radiation and its effects on women.
I want to talk today mainly about the recent developments that we have discovered in the area of cancer, and particularly breast cancer, which has been such an epidemic in the last few years. Everyone has known for decades, as a matter of fact, since the beginning of the century, that radiation causes cancer. very shortly after the discovery of x-rays in 1895, the very first people who used it in medicine began to develop skin rashes that wouldn't heal, sores, and finally many, many of the pioneers in radiation died of cancer. So among all the pollutants in our environment, radiation has been studied the most, and we know that it causes essentially all forms of cancer to varying degrees, depending on the organ and the nature of the exposure, which I'll be explaining to you today. But what has been so terrible in a way about it is until about the nuclear age began in 1945, we really did not appreciate that the very low levels of radiation that we encounter from the environment all around us and from ordinary diagnostic x-rays, a chest x-ray and so on, that these could in some way turn out to be so deadly, because it turns out that x-ray exposures, which are very short, very brief, are very different in their biological effects. And that is why we're, in a sense, misled by the lack of very serious effects of ordinary diagnostic x-rays into believing that fallout from nuclear bomb testing, which measured with a Geiger counter gave only a fraction of 5, 10%, 20% of background, that this could have any serious effects at all on human health, and particularly cancers in adults. Now, the first indication that there was a problem came unexpectedly by an accidental discovery of Dr. Alice Stewart at Oxford University, who discovered that women who had essentially had one or two or three x-ray exposures were fundamentally more likely to have children that developed leukemia and brain cancer and other cancers early in life before age 15. And that was in 1958. So there was an indication of this as early as 1958. And therefore, for the first time, 13 years after the first bomb, we began to find out that human beings could be sensitive to a much greater degree than we had ever known. But people felt that if radiation was prolonged over a period of time, the body would recover. And therefore, there was a lot of hope that there would be a safe threshold, or there would be no effect at all for ordinary levels of background or diagnostic radiation. But in fact, it turns out to be quite different.
And that was Dr. Ernest Sternglass, Professor Emeritus of Radiology at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. We now turn to investigative journalist and author Leanne Clorfine Kasten, who says up to 70% of all breast cancers may be due to environmental pollution. But the EPA refuses to ban commercial toxic incinerators, and mainstream medical groups, both private and governmental, focus on treatment instead of prevention. I talked recently to Leanne Clorfine Kasten about her book Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention, and asked her about what causes breast cancer.
Well, first we have to say one more thing. There really are some legitimate risk factors involved with breast cancer. And if we put all those risk factors together, and I feel we have to mention perhaps the issue of not having children, that can be a factor. There are other issues of perhaps too much alcohol, which all are related, by the way, to estrogens in your body. But if we put all those normal risk factors together, what you fundamentally have is only 30% of women getting breast cancer. There are 70% of the women out there who are going to be getting breast cancer, and that 70% is directly correlated to the environment. And I would like to be able to read something to you. In 1994, industry released more than 1.1 billion pounds of toxins linked to human reproductive disorders. Only 1% of the 70,000 different synthetic chemicals and metals in commercial use is monitored. Then I will go on to tell you that our food, our water, and even our air are all contaminated with pesticides and hormones that the National Cancer Advisory Board recognizes will increase the risk of cancer of the prostate, breast, stomach, brain, and lymph system. But if we eat the fruit and vegetables that the American Cancer Society advises will reduce our risk, we may indeed increase our risk by consuming chlordane dieldrin, toxaphene, and other pesticides. So let's now get into the issue of the environment. A group of chemicals called organochlorines. Notice chlorine. They mostly are chlorine-based. Create such well-known commodities as DDT, PCBs, and dioxins. And these are the chemicals that are now being found as potentially causing some of our cancer epidemic. It's a scary thing because we are exposed through our food, through our air, and through our water. A lot of the stuff that's getting sprayed in terms of herbicides and pesticides contain some of these things. And although we banned PCBs and DDT, they're very toxic, very persistent, and they don't disappear from the environment for a very long time. They also have a tendency to get stored in the body fat of living things. This includes fish, meat, and humans.
The way the PR machine works for a lot of these polluting companies is to raise questions, and particularly to say, well, yes, there are these pollutants in the environment, all the things that you say, but some women don't get cancer. And it's not our fault that some are more vulnerable than others.
Yes, to some degree that's true. But if you deal with things like dioxin, you're talking about the destruction of the immune system. There are many studies identifying that alone. The EPA itself came up with a reassessment of dioxin in 1994. It found that, among other things, the dioxin can mess up your immune system, can mess up your reproductive system and a number of other systems, and that indeed cancer is part of the problem, but it's not the only problem. So not everybody is going to be equally affected, to be sure, but it certainly makes many women and men vulnerable. That's the issue.
What about the industry's response and how you think health activists should respond to it?
Well, first let's go back a little bit, okay? The International Joint Commission is a treaty body between Canada and the United States to oversee the health of the Great Lakes. They have enormous power to conduct studies and to find for various pollutants that are, you know, literally ruining the Great Lakes in many ways. And they came up with a decision which was rather remarkable. Most of the commissioners on the IJC are very conservative men and women. Several years ago, they were all appointed by Reagan Bush. They have been extremely effective fundraisers for the Republican Party. They got involved with the International Joint Commission. They started commissioning these studies, and they found that these toxic persistent chemicals, fundamentally, the chlorine-based chemicals, are so dangerous that they finally decided to put out an alarm and call for the immediate sunset, the immediate phasing out of chlorine as an industrial chemical. Now, industry did not take this lightly. Dow Chemical is the largest producer of chlorine in the world. They did not like this. So instead of saying, you know what, there might be some value in some of these studies, what industry has done is two things. They've denigrated the studies, and then they have established million-dollar funds to hire PR people to tell us how important it is for us to have not only chlorine in our environment, but plastics. And plastics cannot be made without the use of chlorine. So what we're talking about today is a massive public relations industry that is gearing up for not only ads, we're talking about advertising as well, that are gearing up to let people know that we cannot live without these products. Therefore, what industry has done is literally confuse the public, and it's very hard for little books like mine to get the kind of to have the kind of force that that is needed when I am bucking literally the enormity of the power of these polluting corporations that hire million dollar ads and million-dollar public relations campaigns. I have in my book a major public relations campaign identified by the Chlorine Chemical Council, how they work their magic, how they identify key people, how they identify the press. All of this goes into making the public complacent and certainly unaware.
Leanne, explain that, because I think this is an illuminating case study for people to understand how the whole corporate machine works, from the industry that pollutes to the corporate PR.
Well, the Chlorine Chemical Council literally got together and created an entire list of to-dos as to how literally to diffuse the IJC and its recommendations. And they've had meetings. They've had all kinds of experts in the PR industry coming in to talk to how to do all this misinformation, and we're talking serious misinformation here. Identify key people in the media who will be very willing to take our side rather than the environment side. And by the way, it worked. May I tell you that for the last three biennial meetings of the IJC, they have put out again another call for the phase out of chlorine in industry. And for example, our Chicago papers have barely picked it up. It is definitely not on the cutting edge of any media reporting. And therefore, what we have to ask is why? And let's take, for example, the Chicago Tribune. We have a newspaper that bleaches its pulp and paper with chlorine, and the definition of that means you're going to spew out dioxin. As a consequence, the Chicago Tribune has been very effective in detoxifying dioxin on its pages. They've done it regularly and they've done it often. So if the readers alone of the Chicago Tribune were to pick up about how nasty dioxin is, they would find very little on its pages, because the Chicago Tribune has its own vested interest in perpetuating the detoxification of dioxin. And this has been going on. Even the New York Times, at one point, the New York Times was in the business of detoxifying dioxin. They, too, had a major pulp and paper mill that was using chlorine to bleach. And guess what? The Eskimos up in Canada, where the paper mill was, ended up suing the New York Times for $1.3 billion because dioxin does have nasty, mean effects. And one of those effects is, of course, breast cancer. But there are many other effects of being exposed to dioxin. So let's just say the Chlorine Chemical Council has found ready and willing people out there in the media to work with the Chemical Council, because they all have vested interest in the same thing. There are now some paper mills that are literally doing totally chlorine-free. And they are very proud of the fact that they have converted. And I think it's important for us to recognize that when we are consumers, we should ask for it's not just recycled paper, but it's totally chlorine-free paper that we should be asking for.
Leanne Chlorophene-Caston, we're going to be back with you in a minute. Her book is Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. She talks about why the cancer charities like the American Cancer Society are misguided in focusing too heavily on treatment when more attention to prevention is necessary. And as you just heard, how companies are creating the poisons and peddling the cures. We'd also like to get your comments on today's show or suggestions for other shows. You can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Or you can send us email. Our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Coming up tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll be dealing with Yip Harburg. He's the socialist lyricist who wrote the lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, Finian's Rainbow, and many others, blacklisted during the McCarthy era. And we're going to talk about his life 100 years after his birth. On Monday on Democracy Now!, we'll be dealing with the issue of education and race. We'll be hearing a speech by Joe Feagin, who wrote the book Living with Racism. On Tuesday, we'll be hearing new commentaries from Mumia Abu-Jamal. Just before, reporters were absolutely barred from going to his prison and visiting with him. On Wednesday, we'll be talking about other issues and through the week, and we'll let you know about that tomorrow. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and again, when we come back from our minute break, we'll continue our discussion with Leanne Clorfine Kasten, a reporter, a journalist, an author, and a community activist. She serves on the committee of the Chicago Media Watch and chair of its Environmental Task Force. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. As we continue our conversation with Leanne Clorfine Kasten, author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. Leanne, let me ask you, why is it that the EPA refuses to ban toxic outlets like commercial incinerators that are clearly implicated in the cancer epidemic?
That's a very good question. Let me start by telling you that the EPA knows unequivocally that there are some chemical pollutants in the environment that directly cause breast cancer. As a matter of fact, in my book, I mention an EPA briefing where one of the staff scientists actually gave a complete list of all the organochlorines that were now found to be causative for breast cancer. So you've got knowledge on one hand, and then you have regulation on another. Why isn't the EPA more aggressive? Because industry today is so connected to the EPA that industry, for the most part, can pretty much tell the EPA what it wants to do. So let's get into incineration. Incineration is the waste management choice for the EPA. And incineration, on one hand, has been identified by the EPA as one of the major causes of pollution in the world, one of the major causes of dioxin. Certainly, anytime you burn polyvinyl chloride, you're going to get dioxin. Anytime you burn any metal, you're going to get into the emissions a great deal of cadmium, mercury, and lead. All of that goes right up the stack and goes right into the Great Lakes, right into the waters of the ocean on the South and North Pole. But the EPA has a vested interest in perpetuating incineration as we understand it today. And this is despite the fact that there are alternatives out there, which I have written about, that are totally clean, that are closed circle, closed loop things, that manage to not burn the way incineration does, but manage through high heat process to completely change the chemical arrangement of the molecules so what you get at the end is far safer stuff. And these alternative technologies have been tested by Superfund. And guess what? The EPA refuses to acknowledge their existence because they don't have the clout. Now, we're talking about waste management. WMX, that has big clout. Mayor Daley's brother, Bill Daley, sits on one of the boards of a subsidiary of WMX. We are talking massive power here to continue controlling the dialogue. The EPA also allows for the spraying of 2,4-D anywhere. We're talking about the spraying of 2,4-D in pesticides and herbicides on farms, in homes. We've got 2,4-D being sprayed in every suburban backyard through all these chemical companies that promote lawn care. 2,4-D is the other half of Agent Orange. 2,4-D also has dioxin. It also has a number of other nasty chemicals that are xenoestrogens. And EPA allows the continued spraying of 2,4-D. Now, 2,4-D alone is not being sprayed, but what is being sprayed are chemical products that do contain 2,4-D. 2,4-D is a very effective herbicide. Your weeds are gone. And the question is, do we want our weeds to be gone, or do we want our children to be walking barefoot in healthy grass?
Again, we're talking to Leanne Clorfine Kasten. Her new book is called Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. Leanne, you mentioned dioxin, and dioxin is found in cigarettes. And in the last week, a report has also come out linking breast cancer to smoking. What have you found around that?
Actually, I found very little about cigarettes. Cigarettes are simply dangerous. And I say right up front, if you choose to smoke, then fundamentally, it's going to almost negate everything that I recommend in my book. Smoking is a major no-no. And anyone who really continues to smoke is going to do incalculable damage to her body simply because of other factors as well. Smoking does create cancer. But I say that there are many things one can do, but the first thing you have to do is put your cigarette packs down. Then you can go on to do other things as a prevention. And I mentioned a great deal of those in my book. Cigarettes are something we just don't even, it's not even worth talking about. So much evidence is in about the carcinogenic properties of cigarettes.
Well, we talked about the EPA. What about the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which you contend has cooperated with big business to allow poisonous treatments?
Well, it's not just poisonous treatments. There are three areas about the FDA that I'd like to discuss. One, let's talk about the silicone breast implants. FDA regulates that. At one point, three FDA scientists were sent to Dow Corning to investigate Dow Corning's study on the silicone. Now, these were animal studies. These were not done on humans, to be sure. But the Dow Corning studies clearly indicated that there were some problems with the animals, that the animals were getting sick after they were injected with the same substance that was put into the silicone breast implants. What did the FDA do at one point with these three scientists who came back and wrote a report suggesting that perhaps the silicone was not something we want to put into a human body? The FDA literally transferred these three scientists. In the meantime, the corporations that manufactured the silicone breast implants all had exactly the same problem. Their secret documents indicate this clearly above and beyond anything you could imagine. One, that the silicone did create problems, and two, unequivocally, the silicone was going to leak out of its casing. Every single manufacturer knew about the leak. They all knew. And that's what one reason, by the way, that this major $4-point-something billion settlement was handed down early on for breast implant victims. They didn't have to show that they were sick. All they did was read these corporate memos, these very secret corporate memos. The memos were very indicting. So what we have are silicone breast manufacturers, including Dow Corning, that knew, one, that the stuff was a danger to the human body, and then, two, knew that these dangers were going to leak throughout the body and it was going to affect a number of different organs. Let's talk about the bovine growth hormones. Monsanto makes bovine growth hormones. Bovine growth hormones have been shown to have something called an insulin growth factor, IGF-1. That alone has been shown to create breast cancer, okay? But Monsanto and its awesome power was allowed to put bovine growth hormones into the milk supply, and FDA did something even worse. They prevented, along with Monsanto, of course, they prevented the labeling of the milk. so that when you buy milk, you have no idea, the public has no idea that their milk may or may not be laced with bovine growth hormones. And after a period of time, you just don't know what's in your milk, in your cottage cheese, in your cream, or even in your dairy products of any kind, or in your, let's say you buy prepared cake. You don't know what's in your prepared cake anymore because these bovine growth hormones are now mixed completely with all other milk products. We don't know what few dairies are holding out trying to keep their milk from being contaminated with these bovine growth hormones. And by the way, we didn't eat it. Bovine growth hormones are only supposed to accelerate the meat's milk supply. So we don't even need it because there is already an abundance of milk in the popular stores, okay? We don't even need it. So Monsanto has really done a number on the rest of this population. And in terms of, let's say, alternative therapies, there we have an entire story all by itself. There may be alternative physicians out there who have maybe made some tiny breakthroughs for the treatment. We're never going to say of cure because cure is a little iffy. There isn't enough studies to say I found the cure. But they certainly have made major breakthroughs in the treatment of breast cancer that are non-toxic. And guess what? The FDA very often comes down on these alternative doctors, often raids their offices, confiscates their records. And there's one doctor down in Texas who had found wonderful results with the treatment of certain cancers. He's now on trial. He has been found to be, the FDA finally convinced a grand jury to put this guy on trial. And even this is a Texas doctor. The Texas Department of Health says it's not an issue of whether or not this doctor is curing people. It's really an issue of competition. They admitted it.
Leanne, as we wrap up, one of the things you write about that not a lot of people attempt to expose is what you call the cancer establishment.
Well, I think the best example would be the American Cancer Society. They are one of the biggest fundraising groups in the entire country. And they literally have databases so that locally, from our local ACS office, we are going to get all kinds of fundraising letters saying, do you know of somebody who's dying of breast cancer or dying of cancer in general? Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that you've got to contribute because we're on the cutting edge. Well, I can absolutely assure you the American Cancer Society is on the cutting edge of nothing. The cancer establishment is vigilant about having a little blacklist of those treatments that are fundamentally showing small little breakthroughs. And as soon as some physician has found the potential for a breakthrough where something is working either in the lab or on a patient, the ACS is vigilant about putting this treatment and that doctor on a blacklist, and there is automatic no more funding. So what the ACS does is fundamentally gain enough money to continue the perpetuation of more and more studies on another chemotherapeutic drug with the major cancer establishments, Memorial Sloan Kettering, major cancer establishments that are doing major cancer research. But the cancer research almost always goes partly to the big drug companies so they can refine another chemotherapeutic drug. The American Cancer Society has a lockout of anything that might help, especially if it indeed is going to be a competition to the industry.
So you're talking about the American Cancer Society and also the big hospitals, the drug companies. Any other part of the cancer establishment?
Well, the National Cancer Institute claims these days that it is now beginning to do some studies on the environment. And they have, I have interviewed by phone several people who've said, yes, we're in the process of undertaking certain environmental studies. But it's way too soon because it takes several years to do these environmental studies to really come to any conclusions. I can only tell you that they have been doing some environmental studies in Stony Brook, which is in Long Island, where the women there are now 1 in 7. A lot of women are getting breast cancer up in Stony Brook.
This in Long Island, New York.
This is in Long Island, New York. And the women there are becoming very proactive because they're totally convinced it's a combination of the nuclear radiation out of the Stony Brook National Laboratory plus the DDT trucks that used to lumber up and down their streets when during the 70s when everybody was using DDT before they found out how dangerous that was. And that synergistic mix between the two pollutants is causing a high level of breast cancer there and indeed in the Bay Area. So the National Cancer Institute is supposed to be doing some studies. I can already tell you several areas where these studies have already been found to be flawed. And so we're not even sure that there's going to be a great deal of integrity about how these studies are going to be conducted and what kind of findings they're going to be. But this is really a bit too soon to totally come to any conclusions about NCI. They're in the process, and we'll just have to give them some credit. The nuclear issue is just as valid as the organochlorine issue. And when we talk about exposure to nuclear radiation, there are some nuclear experts who say that 75% of all breast cancers alone are the cause of nuclear radiation, often overexposure to medical treatment. And there's a good study out about how the women, especially women who had tuberculosis, who are exposed to a great deal of X-rays early on, now are the direct descendants of breast cancer because these early X-rays were very powerful. There's also major stories about the higher incidence of breast cancer around Three Mile Island. There are stories about the younger women who were exposed to Hiroshima. The younger the woman, the earlier these women were exposed, the more potential they had for breast cancer. Those studies are very valid and haven't been widely publicized in America. We are protecting the nuclear power industry big time, and the nuclear power industry is a direct factor in the high incidence of breast cancer.
Leanne Clorfine-Kasten, why don't we end on the point of activism? What are people doing to fight cancer?
Okay, there's two ways of going. One is political, the other is personal. Of course, what we have to do is start making sure that we have as clean a food source as we can. And I'm going to urge everyone who's listening to, of course, eat your organic food. Stay away from red meat. I can't begin to tell you what's going on in commercial red meat today. And stay away from your milk products. There's a lot of toxins in the milk products because the connection to milk and meat is very high. But on a political level, we can do a lot of other things. The people who work for EPA, for example, are allowed immediately to go right off to work for the very corporations that they're supposed to be polluting. That has to stop. There has to be a way to stop that revolving door so that Joe Fink, whoever he is, who was a major factor in regulating Monsanto, doesn't have then the opportunity to go across the way and then work for the very corporation he was supposed to be regulating. I can promise you we're not going to find a lot of regulators doing a very good job if they think that they have a job out there in the big corporations that they were supposed to regulate. That's number one. Number two, we all talk about campaign finance reform. It's got to happen. Polluting corporations must not be able to control the dialogue. And number three, all that money that's being raised by all these good groups, whatever these good groups are, Why Me, etc., that money isn't just to go to more breast cancer research. That money must go to immediately identify more of the toxins that are poisoning our body. And we've got to find ways to get some of these good organizations to say, we're not going to just fund more breast cancer research. No, we don't need more funds for breast cancer research. We need more directed funds to identify environmental contaminants.
Leanne Clorfine-Kasten, I want to thank you for being with us. She is author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. And before we go to our break, we go to Marvin Gaye to tell us a little about what's going on.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Solid. Right on.
Hey, man, what's your name?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
Well, Marvin, next time we'll play Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology song. You're listening to Democracy Now! And when we come back, we're going to take on the issue of microcredit. Does it help the poor from Bangladesh to the United States? You're listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to send us an email to let us know what you think, suggestions for a new song, you can send it to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, Hillary Rodham Clinton and hundreds of others are gathering at the Microcredit Summit in Washington, D.C. Microcredit, or lending small amounts of money to poor women in the third world, is the latest craze to sweep aid and development groups. In fact, the Microcredit Summit is the official launch of a campaign to loan money to 100 million of the world's poorest families, especially the women of those families, by the year 2005. And that includes women in this country. Here to talk about microcredit and what it means are two journalists. We're joined by David Bornstein, a journalist who writes about development issues. He's the author of The Price of a Dream, The Story of the Grameen Bank, which is a book about one of the most highlighted microcredit programs. He's currently working on a documentary about microcredit. And we're joined by Gina Neff, a freelance journalist on economic issues based here in New York City. She recently authored an article in the Left Business Observer entitled Microcredit, Micro Results. Well, in a minute, Gina, we'll find out why you feel that way. But David Bornstein, can you tell us about this microcredit summit and what is this whole issue of microcredit?
The issue of microcredit, which goes back about 20 years, is basically a very simple idea. It goes back to a number of organizations in the early 70s found that the large infrastructure aid projects were not really getting money into the hands of very poor people, particularly very poor women. And they found that there were a lot of sort of job creation projects that were trying to stimulate the economy and create employment, but they weren't really alleviating poverty. And they found that most people in the third world were self-employed, and that one of the most effective ways to try and help them increase their incomes and be able to feed themselves better, et cetera, was to put money into their hands, because since they were already self-employed, they were basically giving them money to do what they're already doing. You're keying into the way that they've already decided to support themselves. So that a number of organizations around the world simultaneously in the 70s started doing these, making small loans in Latin America. Acción International was doing that. The Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. In India, there was a program called SEVA, the Self-Employed Women's Association. And over the past 20 years, most of these programs have had a lot of success scaling up, reaching more and more people. They found that, contrary to expectations, that these low-income people were able to repay their loans and take larger loans, and that over time they acquired assets in most cases, and things, you know, basic indicators of well-being like nutritional levels, levels of education, of housing and clothing, for the most part have gone up for these people, and that unlike the large infrastructure projects, they're actually able to see pretty tangible results from the way this money is being used.
David, we had you on before talking about your book, The Price of a Dream, which is the story of the Grameen Bank. But very briefly, for people who didn't hear that conversation, could you explain what Mohamed Yunus did in Bangladesh, how he was able to work with low-income women and also get them to repay these loans?
Well, the way the loans work in the Grameen Bank today has 2.1 million borrowers, which is like 2.1 million families in Bangladesh. It's very widespread. It works in 38,000 or 36,000 villages. Basically, the loans are given to groups of women who join small groups, five of them in a group and 40 in a center, and everybody agrees to co-sign each other's loan. The bank has a system, a network of 10,000 employees who basically spend their time walking around Bangladesh, walking around the countryside down these paths during the monsoon and all that. And they essentially go to the villages and conduct meetings where people either pay back their loans or borrow the money, depending on what cycle they're in of the loan. The loans are very small. They're approximately $100 a year, and they're repayable in weekly installments of $2 a week on average. So it's an amount of money that's manageable for a villager. All of the loans are given primarily for some sort of income generation activity. So say, for example, the most simple example would be you lend someone $100 and they'll buy a cow. They own that cow, and then every week they sell the milk, and then they pay back their loan over the course of the year, $2 a week. And at the end of the year, if everything goes well and the cow doesn't die and they don't get a flood or something like that, they own that cow. And then the next year they'll take another loan and maybe they'll buy a rickshaw and their husband will drive the rickshaw. And at the end of the year, they own a cow and a rickshaw. Slowly but surely, according to plan, people are supposed to accumulate assets. Now, it doesn't always work that way. There are problems. There's lots of things that can go wrong. People can get sick. But for the most part, people want to take more loans each year. That's why the program has grown and grown.
Well, Gina Neff, what's your problem with this? Isn't this about empowering poor people to let them decide how they want to spend their own money?
Well, perhaps. I don't think so, though. I mean, in studies of loan control, what is actually seen is that poor women are losing control of their loans, or they never have control of these loans. That is, that their husbands are taking the loans and using them in enterprises that sometimes they're not even employed in about 20% of the cases. What Grameen has been doing is saying that they're lending to poor women to empower these poor women, and yet they've never really addressed why women had higher repayment rates originally than the men. And I think without doing that, without looking at some of the issues of control and power that are being replicated in the Grameen model, then these kinds of issues aren't getting addressed when the programs come into other areas. For example, there's 10,000 Grameen employees. 90% of those are male. I think that's a very big issue when you're dealing with a project that's 94% women.
No, it's true that the proportion of male staff members in the Grameen Bank is a problem, and I think it's identified. I don't know whether or not the bank can actually deal with that. Just to go back to what Gina said, there have been hundreds of studies that have been done about the Grameen Bank, probably around 500 now. And you can't really, I mean, the study that Gina was referring to, all these individual studies have their own biases. And this particular study found that women don't always control the money. In some cases, they control less than 30% of the loan amount. There have been other studies that have shown that there's a tremendous empowerment that takes place among women. There was a 10-year study that was done in another region that showed that that the conclusion was that the women who had been borrowing from the Grameen Bank after 10 years were unrecognizable in comparison to the women who could have joined the bank 10 years ago but didn't, in the sense in their empowerment and also in the amount of money in the household that they control. They called them the breadbaskets, in the sense that things had changed. The dynamic of economic decision-making in the household had slowly changed over time. Now, having said that, this is an area where I think more analysis should be done. I certainly don't think it's true that the Grameen Bank hasn't looked into its reasons for lending money to women. More studies are necessary, and you're finally getting to a point now, after so many years, that you can really look at a long-term change in a family and see if it does affect the daughters.
Some of that long-term change isn't happening. A World Bank study found that there was no significant impact of Grameen Bank loans on the schooling of girls. What they also found was that there's no significant impact of Grameen Bank loans on women in labor market supply, which means two things. Women are not classifying themselves as self-employed. They're not increasingly seeing employment outside of the home as an option after they take Grameen loans. And girls are substituting for home-based labor for women. So essentially what is happening is we're making more work in the home, and girls are taking over that and not going to school. This isn't increasing schooling of girls. Also, a World Bank study showed that Grameen Bank borrowers aren't graduating from the program. In fact, they identified this as one of the serious problems of Grameen Bank. This means that Grameen Bank borrowers aren't increasing their business. Their businesses aren't growing to a level in which they can use traditional forms of banking. Now, what this means is it's kind of a self-perpetuating system. You have these very small enterprises which aren't able to grow big enough to support women, support their families, and not big enough to be sort of formalized businesses. Now, what kind of implication does that have for the replication of this model in the United States? And that's what I think is an issue that the Microcredit Summit, which is coming up this weekend, should be addressing.
Gina Neff, one of the points you make in your article, Microcredit, Micro Results, that I thought was pretty interesting, was the issue of how women pay back these loans, this whole idea of peer groups and villages where the women are put together in a group, and they have to make sure that everyone in that group pays back their loan. And that definitely guarantees a pretty high rate of paying back loans. Yet you see a problem with that.
Well, it's not so much a problem, but is this a development strategy? Is this something that we should be encouraging? Yes, there is incentive. And what this means is that even within a group, women who are more successful at their businesses may be buying out the loans of other women in a very theoretical economic paper. Coate and Beasley found that, indeed, it makes economic sense on a theoretical level that if you have a loan, that a credit line that is secured and through group lending, and one of your group members is defaulting, it makes sense for you to buy them out and essentially make their payments.
Well, even if that's done, it's a group of women doing that,
right.
And you have more women that get money than did before, even if there are a few women that are not going to increase their level of well-being or financial.
That's true. Well-being. But if I am not making my credit card payments, are you making them for me? I mean, we need to look at, usually, this is a risk that is taken on by the lender, not the borrower. And so what is happening now is that financial institutions are saying, let's transfer this risk to the borrower, a borrower who is already living a very risky life, a borrower who is already having to deal very closely with weather patterns, very closely with seasonal changes, very closely with illness, these kinds of things that affect people more directly than if they have access to a larger range of options. So now that these institutions are saying, let's let the borrowers themselves bear the brunt of the risk.
Because all the borrowers will lose this loan,
right,
if one doesn't pay back.
Let me go back to this. First of all, there's two points. The Grameen Bank has been criticized because people have said that it's not a panacea. It's not going to deal with all problems of poverty. And of course it can't. It's a bank. It's trying to lend money to poor people. You go to any village in Bangladesh and you'll find hundreds of people in that village who borrow money from moneylenders at 20% interest a month. Okay? You have an institution that's walked into that village and said, we are going to lend money at 10% of the amount of the local moneylenders. Why has this organization grown to 2 million borrowers? Simply because it's meeting that demand. Having said that, the Grameen Bank is then gets criticized because it's not a panacea. Okay, sure, women borrow money, and then all their problems aren't solved. Then they can't graduate and go to the commercial banking sector. Well, there's all sorts of there's other problems that deal with that too. The Grameen Bank is owned by its membership. 2 million women who borrow from it own shares in the bank. So you're talking about graduation. You're basically telling the owners to get out. It doesn't work like that. It's not supposed to deal with all the problems of poverty in Bangladesh. It's a very simple intervention in people's lives, and it's very much demand driven. Microcredit has the fingerprints of poor women all over it. This is not a strategy that has been imposed on people in villages. It's a strategy that has responded to their needs. People voluntarily join the
Grameen Bank. What about this idea that they don't come out of poverty, even with these loans, that the girls are not going to school more, which is probably one of the biggest indicators of an increase in well-being of a community?
Okay, the biggest indicator of increase in well-being is nutrition, by far. Nutrition, basic housing, basic clothing are the number one things that the bank looks at. And once I said, there have been hundreds of studies that have been done about the bank. The one that I feel is most authoritative now is the long-term study that was done by David Gibbons and Helen Todd, where they spent a year in a village in Tangail and looked at 10-year borrowers. And they basically came to the conclusion that 60% of the borrowers that they interviewed had risen above the poverty line as defined in Bangladesh, which is about 1,800 calories a day. 40% of these veteran borrowers hadn't risen above this poverty line, and the major reason why they hadn't is because they had encountered some sort of major illness in their family. Okay, that was their finding, and they looked at 10-year borrowers. Okay, other studies have found that 1/3 of borrowers after a 10-year time rise out of poverty. But this is a strategy right now that has only really scaled up significantly in the last couple of years. So now, there's still a lot more room for research.
We're talking about Bangladesh, but I want to talk about the United States right now. The Microcredit Summit is happening this weekend, happening starting today, and the awards are being given out for micro enterprise. President Clinton and Hillary Clinton are giving these out. Who is sponsoring this Microcredit Summit this weekend, David?
It's being organized by an organization called the Results Educational Fund in Washington. And this is an organization that's worked very hard to lobby U.S. Congress for all sorts of issues relating to hunger and poverty in the developing world. They have been very supportive of microcredit over the last 10 years because they felt that it's one of the most effective strategies and also one of the fastest ways to really deal with the problem of how do I eat today for so many people in the world. Once again, there are also all sorts of abstract theoretical economic issues that say, well, maybe this won't work in the long run. Maybe 10 years from now something else is needed. But for the average person, and I spent enough time in Bangladesh interviewing villagers, the average person in Bangladesh can answer the question, how do I eat today, you know, with some sort of credit amount of money that will help them be self-employed.
Jeanina.
One thing that I just want to clarify, 1,800 calories is not the poverty line anywhere. That is lower than the poverty line and often called the extreme poverty line. So when we're talking about 60% crossing 1,800 calories, they're still under the poverty line at 1,800 calories.
Jeanina, I'm going to interrupt because we're going to have to end right now, but I do want to get your comments on this summit and what you see coming out of this and what you see happening in this country.
This is being sponsored by Monsanto Foundation, which is an arm of a very large multinational chemical corporation. This is being sponsored by Citicorp. I really think that politically we need to look at what strategies are being usurped by microcredit and by this sort of free market laissez-faire attitude towards development.
You know, microcredit has, for many, many years, was very marginalized. It has now begun to be slightly accepted in the business and in government communities. The Microcredit Summit has a very bold goal of trying to raise $21 billion to reach 100 million families. That represents about 2 or 3 or 4% of total international aid expenditures over the next 10 years. It's not a mainstream program by any means. This is still very radical. This is still not something that there is not nearly enough support for, and this is just a very bold initiative to try and raise awareness about this issue.
Well, Jeanina Neff, in just the few seconds we have left, if not microcredit, what in this country?
I think that we need to be securing jobs, educating people, providing for health care, rather than giving them money and saying, go pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
But a lot of people would like to get some money to
which is not a bad thing. Again, the individual cases can be very compelling, but we need to make sure that this is not a strategy at the expense of other strategies that are direly needed in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Gina Neff, her piece is in the Left Business Observer entitled Microcredit, Micro Results. And David Bornstein, his book is called The Price of a Dream, The Story of the Grameen Bank. Thanks so much for joining us on this eve of the Microcredit Summit in Washington, D.C. I also want to say you said Helen Todd did the study, David, and Helen Todd's son was killed in East Timor by Indonesian soldiers. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our Executive Director is Julie Drizin, and Errol engineered today's show. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, it's Yip Harburg, a tribute to a man who's written the lyrics to so many songs that people are singing around the world. We'll look at the politics behind those songs. And then Monday, it's Education and Race. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!